Lecture 10, The Popes at Avignon.
Hello, and welcome to lecture number 10 in our series on the history of the popes and of the papacy. This time, we're going to take the popes to Avignon in the south of France. Now, we've seen that it was not uncommon for the popes to be away from Rome in the 12th and the 13th century, even a little bit in the 11th century. But in the years from 1309 to 1378, the popes were continuously resident in Avignon, a city in the south of what is today France. Then actually it was safely on papal territory. It was not then part of the Kingdom of France, but it is geographically within what we would think of as France. Contemporaries, for example, such as St. Catherine of Siena or the great Italian humanist scholar Petrarch, condemned this Babylonian captivity of the papacy. Well, for our purposes, our job is not to condemn it or to praise it, but to try to understand in the first place, how did the popes wind up in Avignon in the south of France? And then to ask, well, what did they do while they were there? How did you go about being pope if you were in Avignon? Well, the years at the turn of the 13th and 14th century saw a mammoth struggle between Pope Boniface VIII and King Philip IV of France, as if it weren't bad enough that most of the 13th century had been taken up with these quarrels with Frederick II of the German Empire. At the end of the 13th century, the great struggle is between the popes and the kings of France. And that struggle, in a way, is the background to how the popes wound up at Avignon. Now, the parties to this dispute were interesting and forceful personalities in lots of ways. Philip IV, Philip the Fair, Philip the Handsome. He was an intense, intelligent, proud man. He was determined to enhance the power, the prestige, the authority of the French monarchy. And like all rulers, he was perpetually short of money. Boniface, Benedetto Caetani, was a proud, maybe even arrogant, Roman aristocrat, a learned lawyer, an experienced curialist, a patron of artists, not least the brilliant sculptor Arnolfo di Cambio, who left us a very famous sculpture of Boniface himself. Boniface certainly wasn't the moral wretch that his opponents believed him to be. He had a lofty sense of the papal office, but for his troubles he was cast into hell by Dante in Inferno 19. Some believed he was illegitimate because he had forced his predecessor, Celestine V, to resign. Celestine, the first and only pope ever to resign. Though it isn't clear that Boniface made him resign. He was a monk utterly ill-suited to the job and seems to have abandoned the office on his own. Well, two basic issues divided Boniface and Philip. Philip of France, but also his contemporary Edward I of England, were continuously short of cash, not least because they were almost continuously at war with each other. In 1292, 1294, and again in 1296, both of these kings laid very heavy taxes on the clergy of their kingdom. Boniface responded with a ringing denunciation of this taxing of the clergy in a papal bull, Clericis Laicos, which forbade taxation of the clergy, and it stood essentially on the legislation of Innocent III's Great Fourth Lateran Council that was held in 1215. So Boniface wasn't innovating here in denying kings the right to tax the clergy. He was basically reminding these kings that they had no such right. England more or less capitulated. It would be very complicated to get into the ins and outs of all of that, but Philip forbade the export of bullion from France. Now, more papal revenue came from France than any place else. So Philip's prohibition of the export of bullion from France was terrible for papal finances, severely crippled papal revenue collecting. In 1297, needing revenue, and also because the Caetani family in Rome, Rome at this time was a kind of a threesome of contending families, the Caetani, the Orsini, and the Colonna. So Boniface has got real problems with the Colonna family. He's got to deal with the Colonna in Rome. He needs money. So he decides he's got to compose his problems with the King of France. And he decides that the King of France could tax his clergy in an emergency. And the king even got to decide when it was an emergency. Well, Boniface was trying to salvage the principle and to save face. You see, he was trying, in a sense, to have it both ways here. A little bit later, King Philip attempted to haul Bernard Sassé, an otherwise forgettable character. He was bishop of the little bitty town of Pamiers in the south of France, not a terribly important person. But anyway, Philip tried to haul Bernard Sassé before his court for treason. In 1301, Boniface issued another ringing papal bull, Ausculta Fili, which put clericis laicos back in force. Then again, the king can't tax the clergy. And then he demanded the privilegium fori, the privilege of the court, the right of clerics not to be tried in secular courts. Again, an old, long-standing right. And he summoned the king of France and the French bishops to answer for their conduct. Well, can he honestly have thought that the king of France was going to say, oh, right, and just march on down to Rome and be judged by the pope? But anyway, Boniface's claims were pretty grand. Philip's people publicly burned the papal bull, inaugurated a scurrilous propaganda campaign in French, interestingly enough. They were clearly trying to reach the French public with this, and they forbade any French clergy from attending any council that Boniface might call. Moreover, in 1303, a troop of Philip's supporters went down to the Pope's summer residence at Anagni. They verbally abused the Pope, and they may even actually have roughed the old guy up. Boniface was 80, for heaven's sakes. And a short time later, disgraced, saddened, and a failure in many ways, Boniface died. Don't you almost see here that scene before Canossa Castle, when Henry IV stood in the snow begging absolution from Gregory VII, being played in reverse? Now the agents of the French king go to Rome and hound the Pope. This is nothing like the world of Innocent III. What on earth had happened here? How had things changed so dramatically, apparently so quickly? Well, in the first place, there had been searing criticisms for years of the wealth and secular preoccupations of the papacy. That's part of why Dante wound up putting popes like Boniface VIII in Inferno in his great Commedia. A 12th century satirist already had pilloried, in a wonderful work, the bogus relics of Saints Albinus, silver, and Rufinus, gold, that had been reverently installed, he said, in the treasury of Saint Cupidity, next to the confession of her sister, Extreme Avidity, not far from the basilica of their mother, Avarice. Saint Bernard, writing to his former pupil, who became Pope Eugenius III, warned him against secular preoccupations. But Innocent III, rather like Gregory I, remember those quotations that we had from Gregory I a few lectures back where he lamented the fact that he's drawn into all of these cares and concerns as Pope? Innocent III also wrote De Contemptu Mundi, on the contempt of the world, how awful that world is and how distracting. It's also true, however, that the 13th century saw, for instance, the rediscovery of Aristotle's work, The Politics, which laid out a very different sense of what a state is, what a society is, what a government is, and what the ends of each might be. This was also a time when Roman law began to disseminate further and more rapidly than ever before. Well, when people picked up Roman law books, they found things like what pleases the prince has the power of law. Not what pleases the pope, what pleases the prince has the power of law. We find that writers as different as the great Italian poet Dante and the French ecclesiastical scholar John of Paris could agree that popes should not possess temporal political rule over people. The first faint sounds of the ideology of the secular state, and perhaps the beginning of the ringing of the death knell for Christendom, are audible in this controversy between Philip and Boniface. And so it appears to us that Boniface's position was untenable. And yet, at the very end of his pontificate, he issued the bull Unam Sanctam, the most powerful statement of ecclesiastical right and papal privilege ever issued by any pope. Was he not aware of how difficult his world was? Be that as it may, the bull was without effect. What's a papal bull? It's a papal letter signed with a bullum. A lead bullum is the great lead seal that goes on a bull. So a bull is a document that has been bulled. It has been sealed with a lead bull. That's where the word comes from. Well, it was in an attempt to find some resolution to this bitter conflict that the popes wound up in Avignon. All of that's by way of saying, how in the world did we get the popes up there to Avignon? On Boniface's death, Benedict XI was elected, primarily because he was a non-Colonna. The politics in Rome, they were looking for anybody who wasn't a Colonna. Anyway, so they fixed upon Benedict XI. He managed to achieve a measure of peace in the city of Rome. He managed to achieve a measure of peace with Sicily, which had once again been a thorn in the Pope's side in just recent years. And Benedict wanted very much to find a way to get peace with Philip in France. But Philip was demanding a great church council be called to condemn Pope Boniface. Benedict was not prepared to do that. Now, Benedict did withdraw many of Boniface's anti-French measures, but nothing he did would appease Philip. Philip wanted Boniface condemned. On Benedict's death, he was pope only a couple of years, the cardinals were hopelessly deadlocked for 11 months. And finally, the Bonifacian faction itself split down, the faction that really wanted to maintain a hard line against the French, and the cardinals settled on the Archbishop of Bordeaux in France, Bertrand de Gault. Now, he had a lot to recommend him. He was French, and he had very good relations with the French court. Maybe here is somebody who can compose these difficulties with the King of France. As Clement V, Bertrand created numerous French cardinals, and he negotiated consistently, continuously, with the French court. He managed to avoid a complete condemnation of Boniface. But he paid some prices. He had to rehabilitate the Colonna family, Boniface's great enemies. He had to forgive Philip's agents for the attack on Boniface at Anagni in 1303. And he had to acquiesce in Philip's destruction of the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar were one of the military orders, sort of quasi-monks, quasi-warriors that had formed during the crusading period. The Templars, as a matter of fact, ran a very substantial banking operation that extended all the way from the Holy Land back to Europe. Philip trumped up awful charges against these guys and wanted to crush them because he wanted to seize their money. And the Pope was finally forced to acquiesce in the destruction of the Knights Templar. In his desire to achieve a settlement with France, Clement settled in 1309 in Avignon. Remember, the city in the south of France that is not in the Kingdom of France, but is obviously just next door. When Clement died, a majority of the cardinals was French. He'd been pope for a few years, from 1305 to 1349. A majority of the cardinals was French. The Italians, however, managed to hold out for almost 2 years. But finally, Jacques Duez, who was the Bishop of Cahors, a small city in the south of, in the center of France, really. Formerly, however, the Bishop of Avignon was elected as Pope John XXII. He moved into the Bishop's Palace in Avignon and immediately began expanding it quite substantially because he had to accommodate this enormous papal entourage. We've seen that the Pope is in some respects exactly like all other bishops, but then he runs a much larger, more sophisticated, complicated operation. So the Episcopal Palace in Avignon simply wasn't big enough, and they began building the spectacular Papal Palace at Avignon, most of which is still there today and can be visited. Well, without anyone's having planned it or desired it, the popes wound up in Avignon until 1378, for a long time. Avignon was preferable to Rome in certain ways. There was no Roman nobility to contend with. There were no Roman merchants, there were no Roman traders, financial people to contend with. It was a long way from Sicily. You didn't have to contend with the kings of Sicily. A long way from Naples, didn't have to mess with them. It was comfortably far from the French court. It was not too far from Germany. There always are going to be complications with the Germans. This is also a period, as we'll see in just a moment, when the Hundred Years' War between France and England is raging, so you're reasonably close to be able to perhaps have some influence on that situation. And there were also excellent communications. Avignon sits astride the River Rhone, so travel up and down the River Rhone is fine. There was also a great bridge at Avignon, the Pont Benezet, if you know the children's song. Sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse. That's the bridge. It was there over the River Rhone. So there was excellent communications in this particular site. Now, ironically, the Avignon popes built a continuously effective government precisely because they were continuously resident in Avignon, something they had not been in Rome for two centuries. Paradox upon paradox upon paradox. How might we characterize these Avignon popes? Well, there were seven of them. They were all French. The average pontificate was about 10 years. That's lengthy compared to the second half of the 13th century, but about in line with the length of pontificates in earlier centuries. Most of the elections went very smoothly. Only John XXII faced an antipope, Nicholas V, for a couple of years, 1328 to 30, who was utterly the creature of Louis IV of Germany and really a non-entity and not anybody that we need to contend with here. These popes had, for the most part, had long and distinguished careers in the church. They were, for the most part, learned and thoughtful men. But interestingly, their great gifts were as administrators. These were not, in a sense, holy men. They were not great religious leaders, in a sense, not great reformers, but they were great governors. They were great administrators, hard-headed, practical types. So they don't exactly command respect in the way that some historical popes have done, but there is something, we owe them a kind of a grudging respect, I think, for the work which they did. They refined, for instance, the record-keeping, the judicial and the financial machinery of the papacy as never before. In part, we know a great deal about these Avignon popes because the papal registers, from this period on, I mentioned this on an earlier day when we talked about how we actually know about the papacy. The papal registers, the great collections of papal letters, the official archives, if you will, survive from this period on down to the present. So we've got an enormous amount of information about these guys. We really do know day in and day out in detail what they were doing. For the most part, they weren't so much innovators as improvers. They were always tinkering with things and refining things and making things work a little bit more smoothly. Their relentlessly bureaucratic style engendered criticism among their contemporaries, and as I said, leaves us looking back at them, not finding much to praise, not finding much that inspires us. And yet they were sort of good, competent, workaday popes. Innocent VI, who was pope from 1352 to 1362, interestingly, had to accept the first electoral capitulation in papal history. Now, we're going to bump into electoral capitulations quite a few times in later lectures, so we'll pause and just reflect on the capitulation that Innocent had to accept as a price of election. What it means is that a candidate, well, the cardinals agreed among themselves, whoever was elected, would have to capitulate to a particular agreement. All right. Now, the terms of these agreements will change a lot over the years. In Innocent's case, the cardinals were particularly concerned about the fact that if the Pope kept making new cardinals, it would cost those cardinals already in office power, and it would also cost them money, because the revenues and funds available to the cardinals would be carved into smaller pieces. So the cardinals said before the election in 1352 that whoever was elected Pope had to agree that no new cardinals would be appointed unless the number fell below 16, and that there would never be more than 20. Moreover, all newly appointed cardinals had to be agreed to by the assent of two-thirds of the sitting cardinals. So the cardinals basically said, amongst themselves, they made this deal. Whoever's elected has to agree to this. So they all agree. They capitulate to this bargain, and then Innocent was elected and was therefore required to observe this electoral capitulation. So as I say, we're going to see electoral capitulations on a number of occasions in the centuries just ahead. But this is the first instance of this having happened. Not being in Rome, and not having the city and its churches as their natural environment, led the popes to develop what we could call a palace style, much more fitting really for a secular court. And this style would actually characterize the papal court for the next several centuries. What do I mean? Remember when we talked about the stational liturgies of the city of Rome? Those up to, finally, some 180 times a year, when the vast papal entourage went from the Lateran to one or another of Rome's churches in these glorious processions around the city. The Pope, in a sense, going out to his church, being visibly on display before all the people of Rome. Well, in a palace style, the popes at Avignon are basically shut up in a palace. They don't have Rome before them. They don't have all of those churches before them. So they aren't going out in great processions, stational processions, to the churches of Rome. They are having, like caged monkeys, great displays inside the palace. The people come to the Pope, as the people would go to a king, or the people would go to an emperor. So it is a palace style of rule. And we're going to see, as we go through the Renaissance period and then into the age of the Baroque in the 17th century, that this palace style became more and more and more a fixture and feature of the way the popes represented themselves to the world, how they behaved, how they acted, than had been the case in earlier times when the stational liturgy was really the great representation of the way the popes went about their business. Well, as always, the international situation was immensely complex, and as always, the popes found themselves mixed up in it all. The great issue of the age was the Hundred Years' War. Now, the Hundred Years' War is one of those wonderful anomalies. It lasted from 1337 to 1453. I'm not very good at math, but I think that's 116 years. But anyway, the Hundred Years' War. France and England had been, in certain respects, fighting ever since a French regional potentate, William the Bastard, the Duke of Normandy, had conquered England in 1066. So a French prince has a purchase on England, he becomes the King of England, and he still retains interests in France. So for the next centuries, the English and the French have multiple and conflicting interests. The Hundred Years' War was actually one slice out of that long struggle, out of that long ancient rivalry between the French and the English. One is inclined to think in the course of the 20th century that because the English and the French were allied against the Germans in two world wars, that somehow there's something inevitably about Anglo-French friendship. No. The world changed pretty dramatically on the eve of World War I when the English and the French allied with one another. So, we're in one moment of this long-standing controversy. Okay. The popes wanted the war to end. Popes were opposed to wars, generally speaking. And the popes wanted to be honest brokers of a just peace. We're going to see in the course of this Hundred Years' War, and then in a good many wars right down through World War II in the 20th century, that the popes always took a position of neutrality, or as they often said, of impartiality in great international conflicts, particularly in conflicts which pitted Catholics against Catholics. They said, we simply cannot take sides here. We don't like the war at all. We want the war to stop, but we're not going to choose up sides and decide who we favor or who we oppose. It won't surprise you to learn that both the French and especially the English thought the popes were too sympathetic to their enemies. The English, of course, thought the popes were too sympathetic to the French because the popes are at Avignon in the south of France. The French thought the popes were too sympathetic to the English because the popes wouldn't overtly support them. Honestly, the popes tried to stay above the fray. The popes had another project. They really wanted the English and the French to stop fighting with each other so that there would be sufficient revenues available to mount a great crusade against the Muslim powers in the East. The popes have still not given up on the dream of crusade. The Pope's relations with Germany were, on the whole, terrible. I mean, we don't need to say too much more than that about it. In Germany itself, the Habsburg family, that would, of course, rule in Germany until the First World War, or at least they would rule the Austrian Empire, which was the successor to the Holy Roman Empire, which was the successor to the rule in Germany, but that's not our story here. Anyway, the Habsburg family has emerged in the 13th century and is prominent right down to the 20th. They are contesting authority with the Wittelsbach family. So there is controversy inside Germany. What do the Germans want from the Pope? Coronation as Holy Roman Emperor. What does the Pope want from the Germans? Various kinds of concessions before they'll agree to crown anybody. Well, that's a recipe for disaster, and so papal relations with Germany were, as I said, pretty routinely awful. The South was now divided. You've got Angevin princes in Naples and Aragonese princes in Sicily. Who are Angevins? It's a cadet branch of the French royal family who are centered in Anjou, the region called Anjou in sort of west-central France. Who are the Aragonese? Well, they come from Aragon, the kingdom in the northwest corner of the Iberian Peninsula. So, the popes have Angevin and Aragonese characters to deal with in the south of Italy. Now, again and again and again, the papal states have engaged our attention here. It won't surprise you to learn that when the popes are off in Avignon, in the south of France, it's very difficult for them to maintain the papal states. It had been hard enough for them to maintain the papal states when they were in Rome. What were they able to do? How would they deal with the papal states? Well, for a while, they used legates. They simply sent legates down to try to look after papal affairs. And this didn't work very well until in 1353, Cardinal Gil Orbonos was sent to Italy. Now, he was there for about 12 years, from 1353 to 1365, and this guy was really an administrative genius in a lot of ways. He's oftentimes called the second founder of the Papal States. He really put things back in sort of good operating conditions. But Albornoz and the popes faced two problems, many problems, but among these, let's just mention two. Rome itself continued to be politically volatile, and in the 14th century, a new communal movement in Rome emerged under a leader, a quite interesting character by the name of Cola di Rienzo. Now, the commune in Rome was itself in an interesting kind of predicament. In some respects, they opposed the popes, the papacy, the papal government. In other respects, they wanted the pope back. That is to say, if you're in Rome, the popes being in Avignon is really bad for business. You don't get pilgrims, read tourists. Lots of important things don't happen. All that revenue that flows to the papacy is not being spent in Rome, it's being spent up there in Avignon. So the commune in Rome wants the pope back, doesn't want the pope back. Wants the pope back, doesn't want the pope back. Very awkward situation. In addition to that, up in northern Italy, the Visconti dukes of Milan were trying very hard to establish hegemony in Italy. They really wanted to try to dominate Italy as much as they possibly could. Now, they're trying to thwart the popes. They're trying to thwart the Germans, too, but that's another side of the story. So any efforts by the popes to consolidate their position in central Italy while the popes themselves are in the south of France is being thwarted by the Visconti in Milan. So the situation down there is pretty tricky, the situation down there in Italy. Well, the Avignon popes always planned to return to Rome. Their aim, their intention, their desire was to return to Rome. They knew they didn't belong in Avignon. In 1365, Urban V actually did return to Rome, but he felt very insecure there. I mean, he was French. Most of the cardinals were French. He had never ruled from Rome. And in 1368, he left for northern Italy. By 1370, he was back in Avignon. That didn't work. Gregory XI left Avignon in 1376. He arrived in Rome in 1377. He began settling in a little bit, and just as he began settling in, he died in 1378. Interesting enough, when he began settling in, he began settling in over in the Vatican region, because the Lateran had fallen into terrible disrepair while the popes had been in Avignon. Well, the popes are going to move into the Vatican temporarily. They're still there. In the election of 1378, the 16 cardinals in Rome, six of them were still up in Avignon, elected Bartolomeo Prignano, who was the Archbishop of Bari, largely because of the howling mob outside the door demanding a Roman, or at the very least, an Italian, be elected pope. Well, Bartolomeo, Urban VI, who was pope from 1378 to 1389, initially enjoyed the goodwill of the cardinals in Rome, but then he utterly ruined his relationship with them by treating them wretchedly. Now, he was well-intentioned, Urban was, but I think he would have been a sort of a sincere church reformer if he had been given an opportunity to act as he might have wished. But he was totally inept and probably delusional. Apparently he went around talking to pictures. Now, other historical characters have done such things. In July, the cardinals declared that the April election had been illegal because conducted under restraint and fear. Now, that's perfectly true. Elections were not supposed to be conducted in such conditions, with a howling mob outside the door. So the cardinals decided that Urban was deposed. He wasn't legitimate pope. And they left Rome momentarily for Neapolitan territory, to the south. And they elected Cardinal Robert of Geneva, who took the name Clement VII. Now Clement, slowly but surely, worked his way back to Avignon. He arrived there in about 1381. When Clement got back to Avignon, mind you, Urban VI is still down there in Rome. The cardinals have declared him deposed, but he didn't sort of pack his bags and leave. He claimed the cardinals had no right to declare him deposed. And as a result, there are two men, each elected, in some sense, by the same college of cardinals, a few months apart, one in Avignon, where the popes had been for a long time, one in Rome, where the popes had always been, both claiming to be the legitimate pope. This inaugurates what we call the Great Schism, the Great Split, perhaps in certain respects, the greatest of all the crises in papal history. And just as a footnote, occasionally there is a misconception that the Great Schism is the schism of 1054, when Michael Carolarius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, and Humbert of Silva Candida, the Pope's legate, excommunicated each other, separating the Greek and Latin churches. No, that was not supposed to be a schism at all. Officially, it never was a schism. So the Great Schism is this period in the 14th and early 15th century when more than one man claims to be the Pope, claims to be the successor of St. Peter. To this Great Schism, we will turn our attention in the next lecture.